And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Each week, Ray spotlights in-depth interviews with legendary and up-and-coming authors and music artists. Ray also features the movers and the shakers of the music and publishing industries and suggests important methods for getting the most out of your public relations and marketing needs. Please welcome music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
I'm Ray Shasho, broadcasting from BBS Radio. And welcome to the show where we spotlight legendary and up-and-coming music artists and authors, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or visit www.publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Frank Marino is an invigorating virtuoso and champion guitar slinger who is also considered to be among the greatest guitar players in the world. The Montreal native and his assiduous band Mahogany Rush were one of the elite monster rock acts throughout the 70s. The band performed on several prestigious television music shows, including Don Kirshner's Rock Concert and Bert Sugarman's The Midnight Special, hosted by the notorious Wolfman Jack. Marino jokingly stated that Mahogany Rush was mysteriously omitted from the Midnight Special DVD collector video library released to the public. Mahogany Rush also played for more than 300,000 people at California Jam 2 in 1978. The televised concert featured Ted Nugent, Aerosmith, Santana, Dave Mason, Foreigner, Heart, Bob Welch with Stevie Nicks and Mick Fleetwood, and, of course, Frank Marino and Mahogany Rush and Rubicon. Mahogany Rush was managed by Steve Leber and Dave Krebs, who also handled Aerosmith and Ted Nugent. Some of the band's most significant releases include Maxum, Child of the Novelties, Strange Universe, Mahogany Rush 4, World Anthem, Live, Tales of the Unexpected, What's Next, From the Hip, Dragonfly, The Best of Frank Marino, Mahogany Rush, Eye of the Storm, and Real Live, a double live album. The Sicilian Syrian Marino captured the essence of Jimi Hendrix early on in his career. Rock and roll urban legend suggests that when Marino was a teen, he was visited by an apparition of Jimi Hendrix after a bad LSD trip, which led to the spirit of Hendrix entering Marino's body and bestowing his ability to play the guitar. Marino renounces the fabrication and says Hendrix was still alive while he was in the hospital recuperating from the LSD trip, but he did learn to play the guitar while recovering. Frank Marino was widely recognized throughout his career as a master for performing Hendrix cover tunes. Marino's cover versions were impeccable, and audiences globally would ultimately embrace them. His cover tunes were commercially successful. Roadhouse Blues, The Doors, All Along the Watchtower, Purple Haze from Jimi Hendrix. But Marino was never pleased about his original material, receiving virtually no airplay on FM radio. Marino retired from the music business, but returned in 2001, largely galvanized by his fan base. Most recently, Frank Marino has been suffering from adhesive capsulitis, which is frozen shoulder, and gradually has been recuperating. The condition usually resolves itself within 1 or 2 years, but restricts mobility and can generate intense pain. Marino is receiving psychotherapy, or has been receiving psychotherapy. The condition began after Marino spent tedious, immeasurable hours in a studio meticulously editing his forthcoming live DVD. Please welcome to the show legendary monster guitarist, singer, songwriter for Mahogany Rush, Frank Marino. Hello, Frank.
Ray, I gotta just listen. There's nothing left to interview me on. But I'll tell you. First of all, I do have to correct the record there. It's not psychotherapy. It's physiotherapy.
Well, physiotherapy. Sorry about that.
Psychotherapy. People say, "Yeah, I heard Marino's out there. He's whacked, man. He's getting psychotherapy."
We could all use psychotherapy.
No. It's physiotherapy. And besides,
physiotherapy.
The problem with the shoulders is gone now for years.
It was the first
3 years of when I did the project. So basically 18 months and then 18 months. But it's been gone for over 2 years.
Awesome.
So I'm
very, very glad.
Psychotherapy. I heard that. I almost fell off my chair. I almost interrupted you.
That was a misspell, I guess.
Yeah, and I was thinking, I said, geez, what's Ray going to ask me about, man? He's just already got everything down here.
So the shoulder's doing great. You said it's been working fine now for a couple of years, huh?
Yeah, it's fine. Everything's back to normal.
Awesome. And now, where are you in the project on the DVD? Is it almost done?
I'm pretty much finished.
Awesome.
Pretty much finished. I mean, I uploaded, I don't know if you saw it, but I uploaded a sample of it.
I did. I was going to talk to you about that. Yep.
That's on your
Facebook.
I'm really only at the point now where there's some technical... Like, there's some technical issues, like, because, you know, what's it going to be? Is it going to be, you know, because it's 12 hours, so is it going to be DVDs? Is it going to be, you know, how do I get it out there? I have to get clearances for some of the material because some of it's cover material. You know, it's all little technical issues now. I mean, if those were resolved, I could release tomorrow. You know, it's at that point. But while I'm waiting for the resolution of that, of those, you know, business issues, if you want to call them that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm still sort of looking at it, and, you know, okay, there's a little noise, and then clean that up, and there's a little noise, and, you know, stuff, little stupid stuff like that. But it's pretty well done. It's pretty much what you saw on the sample that I uploaded there. And really, I mean, that's such a short part of it. That's just like 5 minutes of the whole thing.
Yeah, I want to tell our listening audience, go to Frank Marino's Facebook site.
Yeah, it's called Official Frank Marino, yeah.
Official, yep, and it's an extract from the new DVD. It's called The Answer. That's the track he's got on there, and it is awesome. The quality is great. The sound is wonderful. You got a lot of fans waiting for this, by the way.
I was encouraged because, you know, when you've sat with something like that for as long as I have, you really don't know. I mean, you know, honestly, you just don't know how people will take it because you've become so used to it yourself.
Yeah.
You know, when you're doing an album and, you know, you start doing your album in, I don't know, September, and you're finishing it around December, you've only been at it 3 months. You have a sort of anticipation of, you know, you really, wow, people are going to, you know, what are they going to think of this? But when you're sitting with this thing, you know, technically for so long, you really get to the point where you're just not sure what people will think because you don't see it the same way anymore. You've seen it so many times.
Right.
So when we, you know, when I uploaded that sample, I thought, you know, I'd get a kind of a, okay, that's nice, you know, kind of response, but the response was phenomenally good. It went to like 370,000 shares.
Wow.
And I was like, what? You know, okay.
Yeah.
I guess it's okay. I guess it's not, you know.
But you know,
ultimately they're going to be the judge because, honest to goodness, I can't judge it, you know. I can't.
But you're a bit of a perfectionist as well, right?
Well, I am, yes, I am, but that's not really what, you know, you would think, if I say that, you'd think that's why it took so long.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is, you know, the time that it took really had nothing to do with me trying to perfect it. It had to do with me fixing what was a very bad technical problem.
Yeah,
and I didn't fix it, like, to the point where I said, oh, no, it has to be fixed better. You know, there's only one way to fix something when it's broken, and that's, you know, fix it. And there's not a question of fixing it well or fixing it not so well. You know, if a drum hit is not being heard, you've got to work on cleaning that up until you can hear it, and then there it is. But so it's not really, normally you'd say, Frank, you know, you're a bit too much of a perfectionist on some things, and sometimes you take too much time. But really, in the case of this, the time had nothing to do with me nitpicking, and it was more a question of, well, you know, it's either I fix it or I don't use it.
Right.
So I had to get it to the point where it was usable, and as you see, it's on video, so it's not like I could just call the drummer in and say, listen, you know, your tracks were broken, they didn't get recorded properly, could you please come in and play it again? Because if you're on an album, you could do that, you know,
right,
because there's nothing to compare it, and no one's watching the drummer. But on my videos, the drummer's probably seen as much as the guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
And so for a drummer to try to recut it and match the picture, that just wouldn't work. So I had to actually resuscitate the bad sound, on a basically a inch by inch basis, and clean up the drums that were damaged. And the result is that you look at it, and it just really is what the drummer played.
Right.
Unfortunately, it took a long time, but that's really what it was. And there's no, there's no trickery going on there. That's just what it was. It just took that long to get it to that point. Probably because it's 12 hours long, too. If it had been like, mm-hmm. 10 songs or 5 songs or something, it would never have taken as long. But to 12 hours of that kind of music and that kind of drumming and that kind of playing is quite a bit of work.
In our last interview, you told me that not a human being in the world that can do the kind of editing that you do. I'm not improving it.
I believe that. I believe that now.
I'm not improving anything, just resurrecting it, kind of like
restoring
painting.
Yeah, exactly. If somebody told me now, okay, Frank, you've got a choice. You can have a number one selling DVD, or you can get an award for best edited record in the history of mankind. I take the award.
The award.
Yeah, because I mean, so much. how much work did I actually put in the actual gig?
Yeah.
I mean, I basically played a 12-hour show of stuff I've played for the last 45 years. 50
right.
years. But how much did I put into fixing this thing? Was 6 years of my life. And really, could you imagine if I had to do it to the guitars and the bass mm-hmm. and everything else? I mean,
exactly.
There's no way. I mean, it would have been impossible. But, it worked out that way. And I just figured, look, I might as well do this because, it was a gift. I mean, the DVD was a gift from, number one, from God, and number two, from some people who did it for me, as a favor. So I don't think I wanted to turn around at that point when we found out that there was a technical problem and tell them, thanks and everything, and I'm throwing it out.
Right.
So I just, I just decided I would dedicate myself to fixing it, and I did.
Now this show is, it's a Cleveland show, right? And it's from, is it 2010, back in 2010?
Yep.
And it was actually, was it a gig that was like a two-day gig or something like that?
Well, the first night, we got in there at about 7 o'clock and, worked things out with the crowd in there, by the way. So from 7 o'clock to midnight, we were tuning up and getting gear ready. And it wasn't a show, per se, like, people came to a show. It was more like they were coming to a movie shoot. Mm. Like they were there on the Friday and... And so we, we fooled around and we, played Beatle tunes and, all kinds of stuff like that, just getting stuff together. And then the next day we came in at noon and we started playing from about noon till about 1 a.m.
Wow.
And they, the people stayed the whole time. So, it was just a very personal sort of intimate sort of thing. And it was very different, I'm no stranger to playing long time, I'm no stranger to doing that. But 12 hours is, a little more than what I normally do. But it was fun. It was very loose. And you're not going to see any of this, thank you, yay, hello, the next song is this. There's none of that rah-rah-rah stuff. It's, one song after another. We get ready, we do another one. We get ready, we do another one. And it just goes on and on like that. So
well, the crowd looked very enthusiastic from the clip on YouTube.
Listen, whoever was there was pretty enthusiastic. I mean, when you sit there for that long, plus the night before, and the place was freezing and had no heat, it was at the Agora, but people were calling it the Igloora because it was so cold. When they've got to be pretty dedicated to that, honest to goodness, I I can't thank them enough, but, you know, I don't think I could sit somewhere like that for 12 hours. I just, you know, even for anybody, certainly not for me. So, it's very encouraging when stuff like that happens, and it makes me feel, you know, that it's all worth it.
Well, when this officially airs, this interview, we're going to add the answer to the interview so people can hear it, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, I actually wish I had another one I could give you.
Yeah, that's a great song, too, by the way.
Well, you know why I chose to put it up there was that just happens to be the opening track on my 77 Live album.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured, hey, you know, if I'm going to put anything up there, it's my first DVD, and that was my first live album.
Right.
So I figured, hey, why not use the same tune?
Exactly. Why not?
I had put a sample up there the day we came back.
Huh.
Of my guitar solo.
Right.
I didn't yet know the drums were broken. And the guy said to me, oh, we're all happy about having finished the DVD. We didn't know yet there was a problem. I just got home, and he said, oh, why don't you just upload some of it to YouTube and show people? We all expect it to be, you know, have it out in a month.
Right.
And so I said, well, I haven't mixed it. And he went, well, just take part of your guitar solo, and, you know, because you don't need to mix that. It's just one guitar.
Yeah.
So I went, okay, and I took part of the guitar solo where I do Oh, Little Town of Bethlehem because it was Christmas, and I had uploaded that. That's still up there. And so the answer on YouTube and, you know, Oh, Little Town of Bethlehem, they're from the same show.
Right.
But they're years apart in terms of when they were uploaded.
Yeah, I still remember, you know, and I laugh about it, when you played, let's see, I think it was at Cal Jam when you did Mickey Mouse at the end.
Oh, yeah. I remember that. I remember that. Yeah,
I know you didn't like Cal Jam that much. You like being at the gig, but you thought it was very corporate like.
Well, it was.
Yeah.
Listen, I come from a time. You have to understand that when I was a young kid getting pulled into the music industry, which I really never intended to do, right?
Right. Right.
I was just a guy who liked, you know, bands and music and the bands of the time, which were the late '60s. And, of, you know, Woodstock, basically. I was a Woodstock kid.
Mm-hmm.
And so here I was, you know, a year after Woodstock, year and a half after Woodstock, getting pulled into the music business. It was like, what? You know? I couldn't believe it. So here I thought, oh, I'm going into the business and I'm going to somehow meet, you know, all these people who I looked up to, and it was going to be like Woodstock. But it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
Because the 70s really changed things. And I was getting, you know, as the years went by in the 70s, I was going, you have to pardon me for I'm chewing on bread as I talk to you. I'm going through the 70s and I'm thinking, wait a minute, this isn't Kansas. You know, like things were changing and concerts were no longer concerts. They were becoming shows and...
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people were going to see bands for the lighting and, you know, for the big spectacle of it. And it really wasn't like that when we went to concerts in, you know, the Woodstock era. And so I was getting a little more disappointed all the time. So basically the culmination of that was that Cal Jam thing, which it was like, what, you know, this is where we had come to. It had become this commercialized version of...
Right.
Of rock and roll, and it just didn't feel right to me. Never felt right to me, and that's why I always say, you know, Cal Jam was potentially a really good time. It could have been my Woodstock, but something about the way it was run by the promoters and the backstage area. Just, you know, don't forget, I'm not in the crowd when I'm now. I'm in the other side. And I'm having to deal with, you know, people running around with making you sign contracts. And, you know, I just felt like I was in the big TV studio.
Right, right.
And it just seemed really scripted, and it was anything but Woodstock.
Yeah.
And that's why I often say I did not have a good time that day. But, you know, once I got out on stage, then it was like, okay, well, now I'm home, you know, because whenever I'm on stage, I forget about everything else for the rest of the day that came before. It's like that's sort of, you know, my home. I've been on stage since I was 15, and so then I'm 62, so you can imagine how many stages I've been on. And once I got out on stage, yeah, then it was great, you know, but it was all the leading up to it, and they made me wait till, you know, what, 1 o'clock in the morning or something, or midnight,
mm-hmm.
and I was there since like 11 in the morning.
Wow.
And I had to follow Aerosmith, which was really, you know, a big mm-hmm. deal at the time, because they were the biggest band in America.
Yeah.
And so we, you know, it just really was a hard day. So I look at the Cal Jam 2 as being, you know, just one of those gigs that I wish had gone a different way.
Right. Your first gig away from home on a plane was actually an interesting
North
story.
This is in the North Pole. Really?
I can't believe that.
I mean, Baffin Island, man. No, Frobisher Bay and Baffin Island. It was
wow.
Like, hey guys, you know, we've got a guy that wants to have a band for a school or something, and you're going to go actually on an airplane. It was like, oh, because we had been playing high schools, you know, playing school gigs. There was no clubs when we started. I never saw the inside of a rock club till the 80s. So I didn't even know they existed. So the entire 70s was, when we started, it was like you were playing either at a high school or you're playing at a park or something like that.
Yep.
So here we were going to this high school and we're actually going on an airplane. It's like, wow, we're going on an airplane, you know? We get on the airplane, the next thing I know, we're in the North Pole. It's like 80 below zero. It's like ridiculous.
How'd you
but
get a
you
gig
know
like
what?
That?
The people were really nice to us. You know, they gave us little soapstone carvings and stuff, and it was, you know, it was like really cool. But you know, I don't know how that happened. Somebody arranged something, and they needed a band, and you know, the guy that was helping us out at the time would say, "Oh, I've got a band. You know, they'd love to go."
Yeah.
And so we went up there and played for this school for the Eskimos. And we stayed in like a one strip army base, you know, it's kind of like, you know, a landing strip with a little house beside it. And it was just the weirdest gig. But that was the start of my career. It's like, you know, talk about getting off on the wrong side of the bed. You know, that's not too promising.
This was on, was it Baffin Island? Is that what it is?
Yeah, Baffin Island. Baffin Island. That's like in the Arctic Circle, man. It's
wow.
Like, you know. No, it was really cold and really
great.
White. Really, like, all you looked around and all you saw was, you felt like you were on a big disc, a big flat white disc. It's like, where's the horizon, you know? Where's the mountains?
Wow.
It was quite something. But, you know, that's an experience that, listen,
yep,
you know,
exactly.
Not a lot of people have.
No, they don't.
You look back at it now and you think, hey, man, there's a lot of bands that have had a lot of cool experiences, but I bet you they haven't been there.
Last time we talked to you, I was heartbroken to hear that your entire catalog was wiped out.
Yeah,
and probably
terrible.
a lot of people don't know this.
Yeah.
And it was some chick did it, right? Selling those.
Yeah. Well, there was a studio.
Uh huh.
Where my stuff, you know, for all the years I was recording, always
mm-hmm.
recording in the same place. So you're just building up tapes after tapes after tapes.
Yeah.
We're talking
right.
From early 70s till the 80s. And so, you know, that place had stored the tapes. But it was a big studio. They were doing a lot of business with, you know, it was a professional place. It wasn't like just some guy's house. And, you know, you just never think that your stuff's in jeopardy in a place
mm-hmm.
like that. And it would be like worrying about your stuff if you left it at the bank or something, you know?
Right, right.
But anyway, as it turned out, a person who was working as a front office personnel was secretly renting time out to local bands at night, like without the knowledge of the studio.
Right.
And she was basically, you know, putting the money in her pocket and letting them in the back door. But the odd thing about that is that in those days you needed tapes to record on, and they couldn't buy the tapes through the studio, so she would go into the tape storage room and take what I guess she thought were tapes no one would ever want to see again, because they were there for so long, and they were mine. And so consequently, 98%, I think two tapes survived, you know, like 98% of my tapes were all recorded over by other bands.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Erased, you know, yeah. And I only found out after it all happened.
Right.
When I went to finally get my tapes at the end of the 80s, mm-hmm. and found out they weren't there. And it created a big story, but there was nothing you can do at that point. What can you do? You know, and the girl ran away to another city, and
yeah.
It was a big... But, you know, I think about it, and I'm like, how strange is that? Like, who has that ever happened to in the music industry? I mean, has it ever happened that an entire career of master tapes has just disappeared?
I don't think so.
I mean, I can't go back and remix it or make 5-1 or anything. Yeah. They're just all gone.
Yep.
When I found out, it was like getting punched in the stomach.
Now, this was like the vault. Now, did the record company store them there? Or
well, no, but I was always the producer of the album. So
okay. The
record company said, well, you know, they're stored at the studio where the producer did them. So
right. Nobody
cared.
Yep.
It wasn't like anybody was, you know, looking for them because, you know, what are you doing now sort of thing, mm-hmm. you know? Like,
right. Those
are, you know, they're there. They're in storage. One day, you know, we'll need them.
Yep.
And listen, a lot of stuff was stored there. A lot of other bands were stored there. Just that I had such a volume amount of tape because I did so many recordings in that studio that she started going for those.
That's crazy.
That's just either a really weird coincidence. I'm not saying she did it on purpose to me. Mm-hmm. She was taking tapes and selling them. They happened to be mine because most of the tapes there were mine in the deep storage. And, you know, it's just worked out that way. So it's either, you know, coincidental. Listen, maybe it's Frobisher Bay all over again. You know, the luck that followed me everywhere I went, you know.
Yeah.
I still remember when I went to California and we had the big 20th Century Fox that signed us, and it was like, oh, we're on 20th Century, and they're going to, you know, they're going to make balloons and posters, and we get there, and there's like a billboard on Sunset Strip, and it's like, wow, this is like really weird. So then they say, we're going to make these beautiful paperweights that we're going to send out to people with Mahogany Rush on them.
Mm-hmm.
And we get these paperweights, and you know when you have these things in glass, like you can see through them, like the coins in the glass, you know?
Right.
And it says, instead of Mahogany Rush, somebody had the letters wrong, and it said Mahogashni Roo.
Oh,
so I thought, okay, this is a real great start. This is like Frobisher Bay again.
You had some, like, 600 tapes there, too, stored, right?
Easily. Yeah, we had a lot of tapes. Because I was just, you know, I just spent every minute that I wasn't on the road in the 70s, I was in the studio.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just the albums. It wasn't just, you know, the albums we did, because I was always there, and there was always jam sessions and with other people that came into town and, you know, just a lot of stuff. And it just all, you know, it disappeared. Now, obviously, some of the quarter-inch tapes survived, but those are mixes. Those are roughs and mixes and alternate mixes. And what are you going to do with that, really? I mean, you can't really change them. They are what they are. Okay, this one has a little louder guitar. That one has a little lower guitar, you know.
Right.
But I would have loved to have my tapes because, you know, imagine what I could do with them if I had access to the multitracks of the originals like that. And I could today, with today's technology, I could do some nice stuff.
Do you have all the vinyl of all your releases?
Well, it exists. I mean, my mother, who, you know, she passed away, bless her heart, but I'm saying, you know, she always kept... a copy of each record I did, so it's
did
not like
really?
I have many.
Yeah.
You know, there's you know, probably one or two of each record I ever did on vinyl, you know, sealed in the package.
Right.
But, I mean, I don't even know where they are. They're, like, stored somewhere, you know. I don't keep any... I've always found it strange, people who keep mementos of themselves, you know, whether it's posters or... pictures of themselves or their records. I always feel strange, and if I'm in my house and there's pictures of me or stuff, it's like kind of weird, you know. Like I think it's kind of strange. People say I should be proud of it and blah blah blah. It's like, yeah, okay, I'm proud of it, but I don't, you know, walk around with a picture of me in my wallet, you know. It's like a little weird, you know? Like, hey, here's me, you know, on this, and there's me again, you know? Reminds me of that joke about Jaime meeting the Pope, you know?
Yeah, right.
It's not, you know, that's just not me. It never was me, you know?
Right.
I'm always embarrassed by that stuff.
Yeah. The Midnight Special Collection, did you ever find yourself? Did they ever add you to that collection?
Not that I know of, and they never will.
Yeah.
I mean, let's face it, Ray. I wasn't part of this, you know, I wasn't part of the gang, you know, like...
I thought you were.
Well, yeah, I'm part of the gang in the sense that I played the gigs and the crowds knew that I was part of the gang, but I'm talking about inside baseball now, you know, like...
Right.
Frank wasn't at the parties and, you know, Frank wasn't at the special functions and Frank didn't agree with... I hate to talk about myself in the third person. That's so fucking stupid. Excuse my expression. You know, but it's true. I wasn't, you know, sucking up to the business. So, yeah, I'm not surprised, you know, that I wasn't part of the inner circle.
Well, I did find Johnny B. Goode on YouTube. You were introduced by Dickie Betts, so you do have that one on YouTube. On Midnight Special.
Yeah, there's the YouTube versions of that.
Right.
And people
right.
have that. I think Willie has a copy of each thing that I ever did like that. But I don't know where he got it. But when you figure when they're going to put out one of their greatest hits or whatever, and they have the thing on the TV with all the names rolling and rolling and rolling and rolling and rolling, it's like, my God, how many people did they have? But, you know, I'm not there. And I'd be interested to know who else is not there. You know, like, is this another case of the... Frobisher Bay? Like, what's going on here?
Yeah, you know, it's almost like corporate rock putting it, you know, editing it and putting it together. You know what I mean?
Well,
like,
it is very corporate, let's face
it.
Okay, and
right.
I have to honestly tell you, look, I know a lot of people liked the Midnight Special thing that I saw you on Midnight Special and blah, 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 but tell you the truth, I'm going to be really straight with you, I didn't like doing it.
Right.
I didn't like doing it because it was... First of all, they wanted me to what do you call that, lip sync?
Oh, really?
And I said no. No, there's no way I was going to lip sync, you know, like a lot of bands do.
Yeah.
And I said, no, I'm not going to do that. So, you know, okay, we're going to actually play live. And second of all, it's not like you think. Like when you see it on the television, it looks like you're playing in this, like, you know, dark place with the lights and the little stars on the screen, you know?
Right. Mm-hmm.
But it ain't like that. It's like you're in a cafeteria.
Really?
Yeah, like picture like a wide, you know, a gymnasium type of thing, but large, but cement, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it's really like cafeteria style cement with columns and stuff, you know?
Right.
And there's a crowd of people sitting on the floor.
Right.
Like, maybe 150, 200 people, like, not really big. But then when they, and the lights are on. The lights are not dark like that. The lights are bright.
Hmm.
So you feel like you're playing in a cafeteria in a school or something with, you know, you're playing to one of the classes. But then when they get it on the screen, it looks like it's dark and they got the star lights and they've canned Clapter and all that stuff. And you get a totally different impression as a person viewing it.
Mm-hmm.
So what ends up happening is when you're out there in the real thing, doing the real thing, and being the kind of guy that I am is very sort of, I like things real, you know, like I like things to be honest. And then people are walking out and going, you know, hey man, rah, 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 and they're all rah, rah, rah-ing on cue, you know, like the Wolfman Jack stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And you feel like this is like just embarrassing. You know, it's like really weird. So you just feel like you're faking, you know? And so it wasn't my thing, you know? Wasn't my thing.
What about the lighting?
My personality's not cut out for that, you know?
What about the lighting? They always had the band's name behind you on, you know, on stage. Was that there or was that
No, I think
there?
I don't remember, but I think it's like superimposed, you know, like I don't remember them actually doing that. I know they also had the words Midnight Special and lights like that. And Don Kirshner's rock concert was another one I did like that. And it's the same thing, you know, television studio thing. It's really a TV studio made to look like you're playing to this, like, big, dark place.
Right.
But it isn't. And there aren't a lot of people there. You're not playing to thousands of people. You're maybe a couple of hundred.
Right.
I mean, there's little enough group of people that they're sitting in the middle of a floor and you can walk all around them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it's really not very big. And so I felt weird, and then you feel especially weird because you're playing in with the house lights are almost on. You know, yeah, there's spotlights and stuff on you, but it's also bright in the room, you know?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and most people don't know that.
Yeah.
And all television is like that because especially in those days they needed like really bright lights to get the TV to look real, you know, to look good. They couldn't shoot in low light in those days, like, and make it look decent.
Right.
So, you know, those are just some of the things that we've all been through.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not the only one, you know, but maybe I'm the only one that's going to tell you the truth.
Yeah, I think you are the only one that's going to tell me the truth.
I think I am. I really do. Like, I might not have said that like 20 years ago, but I think after seeing just how many haven't told the truth in so long, I think I can actually say I think I'm the only guy that's going to tell you the truth about most of this stuff. Because let's face it, they've all got a dog in the fight, you know, and nobody wants to say anything because they're afraid it might hurt their career,
exactly,
and it's all this political correctness and blah, 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 and I'm, like, very non-PC person.
Well, I'm not into politically correctness, I can tell you that.
Yeah,
right,
like, I'm very non, very much against that.
So am I.
And so I just say what I mean and act like who I am and, what you know, come what may, because what's really going to happen? I mean, the worst that could ever have happened to me is that people might not want to buy my record, and like I really never cared about selling a record in the first place. So it's not like I'm, you know, I don't feel like there's anything weird about that, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think people are obligated to buy my records, you know.
Frank, I emailed you a long time ago, and when I interviewed Johnny Winter, and I talked to Paul Nelson, his manager, and I really try to get you on his last album, Step Back, because you know he was bringing in some, you know, outside. Talent. And Paul said it was a great idea. He said, I love Frank, you know, tell him about it and blah, blah, blah. And then he went ahead and got Eric Clapton.
Well, look, you're the second person, or you're the first of two, I don't know which one came first, who approached that same guy to do something with Johnny.
It just made
and
sense.
And you're the first of two or the second of two to whom he said, wow, I really want to do this.
Yep.
And in both instances, he never, you know, responded about doing anything.
Yeah.
So I don't know where that came from.
I don't
either. But it's not the first time. I mean, believe me, that has happened a lot to me. It's not unusual. That's why when people tell me stuff like that, I'm usually pretty skeptical about it because it's happened quite a bit, you know, like more than you would expect, where people have said, you know, yeah, and then it's become no, or they just disappeared into the ozone or something, you know?
Yeah.
So look, it's no big deal to me, you know. I would have loved to have played with Johnny because I did tour with him. And did a lot of shows with him. And to this day, it's the only artist I ever toured with that I cut my set short so that I could watch him for longer.
Oh.
You know? And I never played Johnny B. Good.
Yeah. Not when Johnny's there, right?
and you know what? The most would happen, I'd pass the guy in the hallway because he always had like a lot of guys around him, like security and all that. You know, and the most that would ever happen is I sort of walk by him and nod my head, you know, hi, hi, how you doing? But it was like I was very shy. You know, guys like him, well, obviously Jimi Hendrix and anybody from his group, one of the great moments of my life was when I met Noel Redding. You know, when I would meet those people whom I looked up to, Carlos Santana, you know, I was just always a wallflower. So I just could not talk to them, you know.
Yeah.
I just couldn't talk to them. I was just very, very shy about saying hello. And
I was really lucky in my interview with Johnny because, you know, there was a time where he couldn't talk too well, you know, because of the drugs. And, you know, Paul got him out of that. And he was, you know, he was in better shape. He was not only sitting down, but he was starting to stand up on stage, and he was doing really well. So I got a decent interview with Johnny, which was cool.
Well, that's amazing because from what I know of Johnny, the only interviews he gave had answers like yes, no, maybe.
Exactly.
That's what I've heard.
Yep.
Did you get that too?
No. I got some kind of funny stuff, and I asked him. I says, you know, most guitar blues players, they always talk about selling their soul to the devil. Johnny, did you do that? And he says, no, I'm a good Christian boy.
Yeah. One of the highlights of my life was Willie Parsons sent me, my friend Willie sent me a video, which is only about 8 seconds long.
Right.
That he took in an interview. He interviewed Johnny, and he asked him a question about me. And I've got this 8-second video of my hero, one of my heroes, saying how much he likes my music.
Wow.
And that, to me, is like, look at that.
Exactly.
it takes like 8 seconds.
That's awesome.
Oh, yeah, you know, I really like Frank Marino's music. I really like his guitar playing, blah, blah,
blah.
He's telling him. And then it ends. And I'm like, Willie, you know, you could have got a little more than 8 seconds.
That's great. You know, I interviewed Edgar Winter the day before Johnny died. And he was talking a lot about his brother that day and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Zach Wilde, he says that you are godlike within guitar circles and you've been underappreciated by the mainstream music world. What do you say to that?
Well, just to be totally factual, because I'm a very factual person.
Okay.
I don't agree with the godlike, but I do agree with the underappreciated. Because if you can quantify underappreciated as guys telling you they'll call you and never calling you back, that's what I mean by underappreciated. Now, I wouldn't say that about the public, because I think they've pretty well done pretty good by me. And, you know, the crowds have always been pretty good to me. But I'm saying of the industry, there's a difference between the public and the industry. And the industry includes the press and the record companies and the management. That end of the industry very much didn't do much to help me out.
Mm-hmm.
But we always had the crowds. You know, we always had the public. I don't think I ever once did a gig in my entire life where the response was anything less than excellent from the crowd. And, you know, you'd think we would have had a few stinkers. So something was working well with the crowds, with the fans. Whatever that is, thank God for it, whatever that is. But, yes, I would agree with the underappreciated, and I mean purely on the business side of it. But a godlike, no, that's something I wouldn't even begin to approach. And even you said in your intro something about, you know, one of the greatest guitar players, or I don't know how you put it about me, but listen, I'm probably one of the greatest guitar players in my house. You know, but I don't think I would take it much beyond that boundary, you know?
You know what makes me mad, though? You were the first guy probably in history to take Jimi Hendrix public, you know, after Hendrix, you know, was gone.
Yeah, factually speaking, you are correct.
And you got a little crucified for that in the beginning.
A little, you think?
And then everybody did it later on. Look at Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Yeah, and they did it like 10 years later.
Yeah.
It was like ridiculous. But the funny thing was about that, Ray, is that once it started to become the normal barometer, okay, by which they're judged by, nobody else got criticized.
Yep, exactly. Only you.
And here's the thing. And here's the thing. Once they didn't get criticized, you know, they came along, nobody got criticized, I still got criticized.
Yep.
And I remember having an article. I was talking to a guy in a newspaper, I think it was around 71, and he was on my case because a lot of times newspaper guys would come to talk to me when I was a kid, and they would give me these like really loaded questions, you know, like really, what's the word, hostile sort of.
Right, right. They're trying to get something out of you. Yeah,
very hostile, you know?
Yeah.
And so one guy was being hostile as usual and about the Jimi Hendrix thing, and I said, and I remember saying to him, well, you know, I defended like the style of music.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was going on about this whole, you know, you're copying a guy and you're a clone and all that stuff. And I was trying to tell him, no, this is a style. You're not getting it. This is a style. It's a new style. Hendrix invented a style. And I said, one day, these were my words. I still have that somewhere. I should dig it up and send it to you. One day, this style will become the way everyone will be compared to.
Right.
And he laughed at that.
Really?
Yeah, he was like, yeah, yeah, sure.
Because he's an idiot.
but you have to understand the context of the time.
Yeah.
Hendrix had just died September 1970.
Mm.
I came out of hospital in 1968. I started doing that kind of music in 69.
You were 16 years old.
Yeah, he was still alive. He died September 70. By then, I was doing it. In 1971, in September of 71, we played, my band and me, played a show on what they called Jimi Hendrix Day, which was the first anniversary of his death on September the 18th.
Right.
We played in a parade on a float that went through the city for like 3 hours, and we played nothing but Hendrix material throughout the city of Montreal. So that's how early we were doing this stuff. So
right.
Then the writers come along and say, you know, in the context of the times was Jimi Hendrix, when he died, was not really the giant star that he became after he died. I mean, he was big from 67 to 70, but by
right.
the time 70 came along, he was doing the Isle of Wight, and
right.
you know, they booed him there, and at Woodstock half the people weren't there by the time
yep.
he got on. So it wasn't the same Jimi Hendrix ba-bang that you had with Are You Experienced and, you know, Axis Bowl is Love and Electric Ladyland.
Mm-hmm.
By the time he was doing the ending there, he was doing Cry of Love. The record wasn't finished yet.
Right.
And he had sort of petered out
yeah.
to most people, not to me, and certainly not to heads, you know, who thought like we did. But so here we come along doing this. So there was a lot of people that didn't like it just for the fact that it was that kind of music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, why do you have pedals and why are you so loud? And, you know, they didn't get that. You know, they were laughing at that.
Yeah.
And they thought that the new thing was going to be, I don't know, the Doobie Brothers or something, or the Eagles, you know?
Yeah.
And so I said, one day, guitar players are all going to be using this fellow, Jimi Hendrix, as the barometer by which they're all judged.
That's right.
And they thought, oh, yeah, yeah, sure, sure, sure. And lo and behold, that's what happened by, what, the late 70s, 80s?
Yep.
It started to be the thing. And today, you have 12-year-olds, it's all Jimi Hendrix this and Jimi Hendrix that, and... So listen, I was vindicated in that projection, but I wasn't like making a prophecy there. It just seemed logical to me.
Well,
it
you know, you're
like
your
he'd come sure. along with a style. He'd come along with a style that everyone was going to want to play.
You had the style, but your covers are so different. You know, you're not playing Hendrix exactly like Hendrix played Hendrix. You know,
no.
you're playing it like
well,
Frank
nobody.
Marino
first
played.
Of all, nobody can.
Right.
Okay, like nobody can. You might get the notes.
Right.
But you won't get the feel.
Right.
And feel is most of music, you know. Nobody actually can do that. You know, there's certainly a lot of artists that can be completely mimicked, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Look, there's
right.
a band called the Fake Pink Floyd or whatever they're called, okay?
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't remember what they're called, but they do this whole Pink Floyd thing, and they're backed by Pink Floyd.
Right.
And they sound like Pink Floyd. I mean, it's
yep.
like there are groups that... There are AC/DC tribute bands, and they sound like AC/DC.
Yep.
But you just can't imitate, with the feel and everything, Jimi Hendrix. You might imitate his band, you might imitate his drummer and his bass player, but there's something about the way he played guitar, the phraseology, the tone, the when he puts the notes in. You're just never going to actually do that. So to say that you're doing that is kind of a fool's errand. But to tribute the guy because you happen to love him, and don't get me wrong, I love John Cipollina as much or more than Hendrix,
mm-hmm.
you know, from Quicksilver.
Sure.
I love Johnny Winter as much
yep.
or more than Hendrix.
Yep.
I love Duane Allman as much or more than Hendrix. I love Carlos Santana as much or more than Hendrix. I love Alvin Lee as much or more than Hendrix.
Yeah.
There's a lot of guys that I really got. The Beatles, you know?
Yeah.
But because I was a guitar player with a loud amp, I'm also a drummer, but because I was, doing my thing with a guitar and a loud amp, of course I'm going to graduate more towards that, the Hendrix side of it. But my records include way more than that kind of music. I mean, I'm doing fusion, I'm doing jazz, I'm doing blues.
Right.
Doing
lots of, and early on too, not just later on. I'm always mixing up my records. So Hendrix didn't really do that. He played pretty much his own one style, and good to him for that, you know. But I don't think a lot of the press, you know, they didn't want it to be true. They didn't want to know that some 16-year-old kid was. Today, 16-year-old kids play guitar. It's not unusual to see great 12-year-olds play guitar.
Yeah.
But in those days, in 1970,
yep,
it just was totally unusual.
Right, right.
And so it was a big thing against it.
Like you said, you were 16. You know, they made a big thing about, and I interviewed him, Eric Johnson, who was, again, you know, playing all Jimi Hendrix stuff. And he was young when he first started, like you.
Mm-hmm.
And he got all these accolades, you know, for doing it, you know. So
yeah.
I guess it was
was able to figure it out, Ray.
Yeah.
You know, but it never really, I mean, I learned really young,
yep,
really early on, I learned to not think about it.
Right.
Because I would pick up newspapers or, you know, magazines, rock magazines and stuff, you know, people used to read those things.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just one bad story after another. So you just got to this point where you just didn't want to know anymore because you just knew it was going to be one bad story after another. And when you're just a child, when you're just 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, and they keep coming at you with bad stories, you know, it affects you. It hurts
right.
you because
right.
you're a kid. You want people to like you. Not that you want them to like your playing, not that you want them to like your music. You just want them to like you. You meet people, you want them to like you. You don't want them to hate you.
Right. Well, you start to
wonder, like, what's wrong? Why don't they like me? What did I do? I never met this guy. You know, like, why is he saying these things about me?
Right, Frank, I think it's time for you to come back. I really do. I mean, you know, rock and roll needs you bad. We need your kind of, you know, powerhouse play. We need the guitar aficionado type playing. There's nothing like that on the radio anymore. It's gone. It's all crap, you know, on mainstream radio.
But think about that, Ray. You may be right.
Yeah.
But then you say, come back. But even if I come back, as people say, where am I going to come back to? I mean, they're not going to put me on radio. They're not going to put me on video. They're not going to put me there because I don't fit the mold. And everything about the reason you don't like radio anymore is because it is in a mold.
Yeah.
And it's not because I come back or even if Jimi Hendrix came back, it's not going to change the mold. The mold is now running the whole show.
How did the mold change?
That's what's happened.
How can we change the mold?
You know what? I don't think music will ever change it. I don't think.
Really?
You know what happens if you actually look at the watersheds that have happened in history, the big mm-hmm. changes that have come along?
Yeah.
Music was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And within music, guitars were another part. Okay, so you had music with the Beatles. All of a sudden, it was Beatlemania, and everyone wanted to be in a band. And then the next big change was the electric guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when Jimi Hendrix solidified that after Clapton and Cream, Jimi Hendrix came along and said, no, no, here it is. Boom, the electric guitar player.
Right.
And that was the next big change. And where was the next real shift? I mean, music then started to become derivative of itself, not just that people were deriving stuff from individual artists like Hendrix or whomever, but music was deriving itself from music. It started to be a caricature. And people forget that the Woodstock generation, you know, people who went to Woodstock went to a pop festival, not a rock festival. And they went to a festival that was nothing but different bands every time. It wasn't all the same bands.
Right.
You know, they were very, very varied. And then all of a sudden the festivals became labeled, and then it was like the rock one and the metal one and the punk mm-hmm. one and Oceaga and, you know, all these different labels and homogenized so that people could make money off of it.
Right.
You know, at Woodstock, they had to open the doors and let people in. I mean, it was, you know, it wasn't like, oh, boy, we're going to make a ton of money. I mean, they thought they'd make money, but they couldn't control it. And they were just tearing down the gates, and it was a happening. But then it became very controlled, and radio became a big part of that. They started, the radio wasn't choosing their own tunes. A&R guys weren't choosing their own tunes at radio. They were subscribing to these consultants that would tell them what they should listen to. And that's why you hear Led Zeppelin 18 times a day on every station as you drive across a 4,000-mile country.
I hate that.
You know? I mean, did you ever wonder why that happened? I mean, when you start in Florida, drive across the country, and the radio is the same all the way to the other side of the country. Now, that shouldn't be like that.
Yeah, of course not. You know,
unless they're getting their info from the same people.
When I was in radio the first time, I was a top 40 guy back in the late 70s. Mm. And we had a playlist, but we could go off that playlist and play anything else we want, you know, to kind of mix it in. So we had a little bit of control there, you know.
Yeah, but I've got news for you, Ray. Today, I've been to I went to some of the FM stations that I used to go to because I have friends that were working as DJs and stuff.
Right.
You know? They don't even have the records there anymore.
No.
Or the CDs. They have a computer with a screen and a bunch of squares on it that they touch with their thumb that have to come in a certain order, and they're not even telling you what's going to be in there. Someone's putting that in the computer for them. You know, remember the Abrams conventions and all those conventions? They would, you know, subscribe to Lee Abrams and all these guys who would tell them, this is what we're playing this year.
Yep.
And everyone would say, yes, sir. That's where Frank Marino, the third person I'm talking about, did not fit.
Mm-hmm.
Because I never agreed with it and said so.
You didn't want to play the game.
it's not just that. I'd say so. That's the difference. A lot of my compatriots didn't agree with it either.
Yeah.
85 to 90% of them didn't agree with
it. They just didn't want to say it out loud.
But they didn't want to say it out loud.
Yeah.
And I didn't care.
Frank, I'm going to read a couple of statements, and then I want you to respond, okay?
Yeah.
Because I love your explanation of the music industry. Okay, the business of music became stronger and more important than the art of music. Today's music is led by people who don't give a damn about music. This was said by Derek Sutton, who's the manager of Trower, and he managed Styx, and he's like one of the last.
Sounds like something
pioneers.
I said.
It's very similar. Oh no! Did you say that one? You could have said that one. But
well, I summed it up. I summed it up easier. Yep. I said, "Business has no business in the music business."
Right. Right. Exactly. And Derek also said the music industry may need to totally collapse in order for a new generation of entrepreneurs and people who care about music rebuild it.
That's right.
So, you
that's
agree
right.
With that?
I'm gonna caution. I'm gonna give them a little tip on that for those who hear that and say, "Yes, let's do it." Okay.
Right.
They better start thinking about sound.
Yep.
Because it ain't playing that's going to get you there anymore.
Right.
Because everybody plays.
Mm-hmm.
12-year-olds play.
Right.
It ain't about how good the guy is, you know, or how physically amazing the guy is. I've seen them billions now with the speed demons and guys playing with their toes, and, you know, it doesn't matter. None of that matters. This isn't a dog riding a bicycle on a high wire anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is like... You want music, it should be music. And people forget that music is an individual part of the music business. It may come out of the artists, but it's got a life of its own. In the same way I have a child and he then has a life of its own, music is music. And it's part of us, but it's separate from us.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to respect it. Once we blow it out the ether, once we play it on our guitars or our keyboards or our drums or our vocals, once we record it, it's out there, and you have to respect music itself as for what it is. But if you begin to bastardize it and package it up and sell it as shiny plastic, it's not going to treat you well in return. And you're going to pay the price in that you're going to end up with exactly, you know what they say, you sow the wind, you reap the whirlwind.
Sure.
So go on with the quotes.
I agree. Well, no more quotes, but Frank Zappa's got a great YouTube video when he talks about the music industry. I don't know if you saw that one or not.
He says we had the guys with the cigars saying, but the kids like it. Yeah.
It's awesome, isn't it?
Yeah.
At least they took a chance. You know, the guys with the cigars would put it out there, see if they like it, and the young guys that came in thought they knew everything, they wouldn't take a chance.
Absolutely,
on
yeah,
absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
And really, the only reason the young guys came in It's because the guys with the cigars said, hey, get him to do it.
Right.
He's young.
Exactly.
He might know.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah, he's not getting coffee anymore. Now he's part of the, you know, process.
Yeah, and you know how many A&R, how many offices I walked into A&R directors when I was over at Sony, or which was Columbia at the time?
How many?
You'd walk in the office, and you'd see stacks and stacks of cassette tapes.
Right.
And I mean, you have to look around them to find the guy behind his desk.
Really?
You think this guy was actually sitting there and re-listening to these tapes?
That's sad.
No way. They didn't even want to accept these tapes anyway because they were afraid that if they even took the tapes and rejected them, that if one of their artists happened to play something similar to one of the tapes, they'd be, you know, sued. Look, I sent you my song on July the 4th, and, you know, look, it came out on August by this other artist just by coincidence. So they would say, we don't accept unsolicited material, meaning it has to come through someone we know.
That's bullshit.
You know?
You know,
but no one was even listening to the music.
I'm an author, and I've got a third book I want to get published, you know, the traditional way.
Yeah.
And it includes all the interviews that I've done, including yourself. And it's you know, like 120 interviews. I can break it up in a, you know, like a series. Nobody, you know, if it's unsolicited, they won't take a look at it. It's the same
thing.
And
the reason is they don't want to be charged later with, you know, some kind of publishing problem.
Great. You know, it'd be a great coffee book, coffee table book, you know?
Yeah.
And none of the guys that I've interviewed are not with us anymore. They all passed away, you know? So.
But, I mean, really, we have the great equalizer today in the Internet. So, I mean, we don't need these companies anymore.
I mean,
I know we think we do.
Yeah.
Publishers and record labels.
True.
And we don't need them.
You don't need them anymore.
Everybody can do the same thing. I know one of my friend's daughters, who's only 23 years old, is a YouTube star doing her makeup, and she makes $600,000 a year.
That's right.
She's just doing it in her house.
It's crazy, isn't it?
We don't need these people anymore. We just need to get our stuff out there and see what happens. But in my case, like with the DVD, I probably, you know, how can I can't really make money on it. Nobody's buying DVDs, you know. Like, so I've put all this time into this thing, my life, my soul, my blood, my shoulders, and really in the end, as soon as it goes out there, it'll be copied by a million people and shared.
I know.
You know? So it's not like I'm going to get anything out of it, you know. So what am I going to do? Go find some company? What are they going to do for me?
Yep.
I mean, unless somebody comes along and says, okay, you know, here's what we'll do. We'll do it this way, and you'll make this, and they'll make that, and everyone's going to be happy, and it's fair. Fine. That's great. But I just don't think that's going to happen. Listen, did you ever see the movie The Sixth Sense?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so that's what I think the music industry is today. That guy, he's been dead all this time, and he doesn't know it.
Yeah.
That's what's happening to the musicians in the industry today. They think there's still this big chance.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's not only that it died, it's that it died so long ago.
It was a long time ago. I agree with
you.
Yeah,
like a really long time ago.
Yeah, it sure did.
I don't mean to... Listen, this shouldn't make anyone feel down. This should make actually people feel up.
Mm-hmm.
Because what it means is, hey, now we really can do the music we love.
That's right.
And we're going to be able to go out there, and there will be a niche of people who will like what we do. We don't have to go through the gatekeepers anymore.
Right.
You know, you want to do punk, you do your punk. You want to do blues, you do your blues. You want to invent something new, go ahead and do that. Want to simply do pop or cornflakes music, just do that. Because guess what? Everybody's going to be able to find their crowd.
Right.
And you don't have to get the other guy's crowd to have a crowd for yourself. The gatekeepers made us believe that it had to be done a certain way by certain rules to get to the place you wanted to go. And that consequently left a lot of people out of the loop because they could never get started. But guess what? My success doesn't mean that someone else has to be unsuccessful.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody can be successful.
Sure.
There's enough room for everybody. There's enough people for everybody. And people who want to buy your album, it's not going to stop them from buying mine.
Right.
Or supporting me.
That's right.
But somehow, when you gigged around like I did with all those bands in the 70s, you had this attitude that, you know, it wasn't enough for them to do well. They only thought they did well if you did bad.
Mm-hmm.
They were judging how well they did by how bad you did.
Right.
It just became ridiculous.
<laughs> It's
like rivals for the same girl. That's how they, you know, that's like how they were treating it. But actually,
yeah.
You know what? It's the reality is that it's no non-rivals, and there's lots of them.
Yep.
Lots of partners and girls that we can find. You know? It's people get really... I can always tell who the guitar players are in a show because they're always standing at the back of the room with their arms folded.
Yeah.
You know, what's with that? You know, why do people have this competitive thing when it comes to music? I love competition and stuff. I love hockey and football, baseball, and, you know, whatever that you can compete in, you know? It could even be chess. I love chess.
Mm-hmm.
But not music.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as one guy better than another.
Right.
That's very subjective.
I agree with you.
You know, someone has to show me the objective truth and the fact that Jimi Hendrix is better than X.
Mm-hmm.
It's just subjective. My dad wouldn't agree Jimi Hendrix is better than somebody. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just subjective.
Yeah.
So there's no need for a competition. Everybody's got their audience, and it's great that you've got your book. You write your book. And if you have to, go to Kickstarter to get it funded.
Yeah, I got to try that.
Yeah, just go ahead. You will get it.
Yeah,
you know, you'll get it, man. Or I'll bet you if you even put it out as donation where you'd make some money. Because at the end of the day, people are a lot more honest than we give them credit for.
Mm-hmm.
The rank and file whom I've always been associated with, okay, I'm a guy who does not sit on the other side of the stage and walk and go in limousines and detach myself from the public. I've been hanging around with the public since 1970.
Right.
And it drove my managers crazy when I'd be on the road or at gigs or doing these big festivals, and I'd finish my gig and I'd go sit in the crowd. What are you doing? What are you doing? If they, you know, if they think you're like them, they won't buy your records. That's what they tell me. I say, well, that's just too freaking bad. I am like them. And I don't care if they buy my records.
I love your attitude, man.
But it's just a normal... Listen, what my attitude is exactly yours. It's
yeah, it is.
99.999% of the people listening to us talk about this have my attitude.
They just won't say it out loud. Yeah.
No, I'm saying the listeners, man. They'll have my attitude.
Oh, the listeners,
you know
that
too,
definitely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
99.9, just the great majority of listeners who love music, who like music, whatever, who get off on music, who use it to drive their cars, whatever.
Yep.
They all think like I do. They
sure.
don't think that there's a, should be a specialness and one guy should look down on another. Nobody's going to agree with that, and yet that's what the artists do.
Yep.
And I don't get that. Where are they getting this? You know, it's like my friend once said to me, Poor Elvis, he couldn't go anywhere, And then my other friend said, yeah, well, when you walk around in a cape. You know, you gotta be, that was Willie that said that, Willie Parsons. I thought I died laughing when he said that to me. He says, yeah, well, when you walk around in a cape, it brings it all home, you know.
Exactly.
The movie stars that say, oh, no, the paparazzi are after me. They're after me. They want to take pictures of me and my family. Well, you know what? Get up every day, 10 o'clock in the morning, go out to the front of your house and give everyone pictures of yourself.
Yeah.
Okay? Like, take pictures of everything you do.
Yeah.
And then they'll be worth nothing, and the photographers will leave you alone. But they don't want to do that because they like that. They like the fact that they feel special and they can complain about it.
I covered John Mayall. He was here in Sarasota for his 80th birthday, you know.
No, I played one of my first big gigs with John Mayall.
Nothing big, you know. I was backstage with him. He had a cake, and he was kind of, you know, by himself. But he was up there setting up his own equipment before the show. He was out there in the on the side selling his CDs, taking pictures with the fans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was cool. I mean, people like me look at John Mayall as a legend, you know?
Yeah,
I mean,
and he is.
Blues Breakers and all that,
and he
you
is,
know?
Yeah, for sure he is. But
I
you got to be careful of one thing, Ray. You got to be careful of one thing. That barometer that you're judging by, you know, he's sitting there, he's giving them the records. In the case of John Mayall, you're absolutely right. He's a normal guy.
Right.
You know, but there are some who do that now because they must.
Right.
And I used to say that all the time. I used to say, that's how you know who's going down the escalator, because all of a sudden they're doing meet and greets.
Yep.
And you couldn't meet and greet these guys to save your life when they were on the up escalator.
Exactly.
Okay? You couldn't even meet and greet them if you were playing on the same show with them.
Yep.
Never mind being a part of the public.
Right.
But all of a sudden, they're on the downside, they're not playing so many arenas anymore, not even theaters, and they're in some small clubs. It's like, hey, come and meet the band, and we're going to sell you our wares and say how happy we are to meet you.
Right.
Okay? There's a lot of narcissism that goes on in our business. And it begins with the fact that the motivation behind why people are in a band in the first place. My motivation of being in a band is for really not very complicated. It's to have fun and to be with friends and maybe go eat after the gig. That's basically it. Okay? So the money, I don't care. The fame, I really don't care. And
right.
I never did.
Yeah.
But many guys do.
Yeah.
And from my standpoint, that's just the wrong thing, because you know what? We're just not that important.
Yeah.
We're not curing cancer. We're
right.
not doing anything that's amazing for the world. And every time I see something happening in a room, I don't care what room I'm in. I could be in the forum watching somebody, you know, do something amazing, or I could be in a room where a guy's giving a political talk.
Mm-hmm.
I do this thing where I jump out of my body, like in my imagination. I jump out of my body and go through the ceiling and up into the sky until the house becomes so small. And then you see that little house, you can't even see it anymore, and you notice how many other lights are around in the city, and then finally
right,
the country,
right.
and then the oceans. And at some point, you get to the point and you go, that's not important.
Yeah.
That little dot down there that was so important 5 seconds ago when I was in that room
yep.
is just not important. And I don't care what's going on in that room, it's not important.
Yep. I agree. Frank, we got to wind it down now.
Okay.
I just lost my train of thought here. Oh, okay. Now that the DVD comes out definitely this year, correct?
Well, I hate to say definitely. I'm not going to say definitely. I'm going to say definitely. I hope so. I mean, look.
Okay.
God willing, you know,
God willing,
because I do not plan a thing,
okay?
Because I've learned the hard way. You know that guy with Murphy's Law?
Yeah.
He has nothing on Frank, okay? Frank's Law is like Murphy's Law on steroids. So I don't tell you that anything's going to happen.
Okay.
Okay, but
we'll
you know what?
We'll keep checking your website, right?
Hey, look, I put that thing on YouTube, and it's written available 2017.
You did.
I put that out at the beginning of 2017. So I'm giving myself a lot of leeway here. Because I could have said available in February.
We're hoping 2017.
Yeah, we're hoping.
Now, once this thing is released, do you think you're going to start playing some gigs?
I'd like to.
You should.
I haven't been doing anything for a long time, but
yeah.
I'm still playing at home, you know.
Yeah, start
I'm
playing.
I'm okay with that too, you
playing
know.
Playing around town. Well, play around town and then work your
Actually,
way up.
I just got an offer to go to England and do some stuff, but I don't know. It's the same story. I get all these offers. I say yes, and then I never hear from them again.
You would be huge overseas. That's where it's at. I think Europe, Japan, you know, Holland. I think
this guy says, I think I can put 10 or 20 dates together in England with a couple of festivals for next year.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, sure, let me know. But this has happened at least 10 times in the last 2 years where I've had these offers. I said, yeah, let me know, and I never heard from them again.
Hmm. Well, you can do it.
So
you
maybe
can...
now they're going to see the DVD. They're going to say, 375,000 people went and looked at it. Oh, now we want them.
Yep.
You know?
Well, I can get you a gig in Florida. I did... I can't. I got Corky Lang.
Oh, and, Corky, I know very well.
Yeah, I got Corky Lang. He's a good friend. He played at the Largo Cultural Center here. Did very, very
well. Corky
well.
And I go way back. He played on my third album.
Yep. He's a good guy. I met him here in Florida a couple of times. He comes to Venice. But he's got a. But
look, I mean, that's the thing for me to go out on the road. I've got to have like a plan. Like somebody's got to figure something out and get it all together because I'm just not the guy to do it.
Right.
You know. So, I'll go when they tell me to go, and I'll stay home if they tell me to stay home. Honest to goodness, I've always been like that. I just don't care.
Do you have a good manager?
No, I don't have any manager.
You don't have any manager. How about PR? No,
I don't have anything. I have, me and my wife. I mean, it's
right.
And I'm okay with that. You know, like, they call me, they email me, you want to go, I go.
A lot of managers now are their wives. You know that? The wives have taken over as far as...
Well, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Because they know the business. They see it happen from, one side for a long time.
And your kids are probably grown by now, right?
Yeah. But my kids have gone on every gig with me that I've ever done since they were born.
I remember that, yeah.
So, I don't know where, what it'll turn out to be, and in the end... I'm a very big believer in God. I'm a very religious guy.
Yes.
I just cannot believe that I've done this for 6 years for nothing. So
right.
God will tell me what to, and I don't mean tell me. I don't want people to think I'm nuts. it's not like I'm going to hear a voice come through the ceiling, but I'm speaking euphemistically.
Right.
God will tell me what to do when it's time to do it. Something will present itself.
I'm in the same boat, man. I've been doing these interviews now for 7 years, with hardly any, no money.
Yeah.
For the love of music, and I'm still waiting for my calling. something's got to happen.
It will happen. Just have hope. I'm not going to say have faith because too many people say that and they don't know what they're talking about. I think have hope. Hope is a good way to get faith.
Right. Well, Frank, thank you, man, for being on the show today. I always love talking to you. I want to get you on the show again at another time. I want to talk about theology because you're quite an expert on the subject.
One of these days we should do that because that's the only thing that I really like to talk about.
I know, and you can go on and on about it.
And I really love the way your guy says, the Ray Shasho Show. Shasho Show. I'm like, three FHs in a row. Shasho Show.
Reminds me, remember that commercial, Susie Chapstick?
Yeah.
we can't wait for the DVD. You got a lot of fans. I got like, 12,000-15,000 friends on Facebook because I got like 3 Facebook accounts, and everyone loves you and Mahogany Rush, and they're all...
Well, share the answer. I want them to see it, Share it on your site.
I will. I'm going to put it on all my music sites. I'm going to put it on Facebook, and I'm going to share it with everybody. And anything I can do for you, let me know, all right?
Anytime, Ray. I wish I could get together with you one of these days. We can meet in person and just, have a cup of coffee or something.
Well, that would be cool, but you got to, I think we're kind of both hermits.
Yeah, we certainly are.
So am I. I don't get out much either, so.
I'm the king hermit. King hermit.
We'll go to a hockey game, We'll see.
Oh, that would be something, yeah.
We'll see the Habs play the Caps or something in the playoffs.
All right, man. All right.
All right, man.
Well,
thanks,
call me
Frank.
Anytime, man. You don't need to do an interview to call me, Ray. You could just call me.
I will. I'll call you.
Okay? Just call me, please, from time to time. Let me know how you're doing.
All right, man. Thanks, Frank.
I'll speak to you later.
All right. Take care.
Ciao.
Visit www.mahoganyrush.com for further information, concert updates, and the very latest news on the release of the Mahogany Rush live DVD. Also visit Mahogany Rush on Facebook, www.facebook.com/official Frank Marino. Very special thanks to Doug and Don Newsom with BBS Radio for making it all happen every show. Join me biweekly Mondays at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on The Ray Shasho Show. If you have comments or suggestions or would like to be a guest on The Ray Shasho Show, call 941-877-1552 or email us at ray@publicityworksagency.com. And don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of an Eclectic American Family and Their Wacky Family Business, or the second edition entitled Wacky Shenanigans on F Street, Proud to Be Politically Incorrect in Washington, D.C., available now at Amazon.com. And I promise you will live it. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to The Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Join Ray Shasho every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on PBS Radio, Station 1.